Tonight on Arena, a great new documentary on Marianne Faithfull, new essays on The Monumental, and the man behind the new musical on Johnny Cash and June Carter. You're very welcome along to Tuesday night's Arena. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32, and you can email arena@rte.ie. Broken English is probably the only name you could give to a documentary about the artist Marianne Faithfull. Not only is it the title of a Grammy-nominated album that in 1979 marked a significant comeback against all odds, personal and professional, in her life, it hints at the innovative, fragmentary approach the directors take to telling that remarkable story. Jane Pollard and Ian Forsyth are the directors in their reframing. Tilda Swinton plays a bureaucrat in charge of the Ministry of Not Forgetting, with George Mackay as the record keeper, the man who shows Marianne old footage of herself performing and in many TV interviews. I'm delighted Jane Pollard joins us now. Jane, tell me first of all about the structure that you chose to use for this and why, because it is genuinely innovative.
Oh, thank you. Well, I don't think you can face making a film about an artist as complicated and interesting and exciting and as who's had such a remarkable career as Marianne Faithfull, and not attempt to do that by meeting her creatively with it. So that was really our idea at the outset, was how do we make this but fill it with her spirit and her ideas? How do we go in not deciding it from the outset what this should be, but let her guide us and show us what it is that she's, you know, has meant the most to her through her life? And wow, what a journey we went on. It's been an incredible process making it. It's been amazing to get to know Marianne. What a brilliant woman. But yeah, the film itself has turned out, it's turned out all right, I think.
It's not the first time that you've done documentaries like this. You did the BAFTA award-winning 20,000 Days on Earth about Nick Cave. You've made films about Gil Scott-Heron and The Cramps. But when did Marianne occur to you as possibly the next project?
You know, she didn't. It was brought to us shamefully, and exactly why we titled this Broken English is her reputation in England is still broken. And Ian and I were school kids in the 70s and 80s who grew up only ever hearing that awful lie that was told about her after the Redlands drug bust. And she'd really kind of got stuck in that rut of being Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend, and the 30 or so albums that came after that, the astonishing accolades and achievements, all pretty much passed us by. That was until artists that we do know very well started working with her. So Nick Cave and Warren Ellis, Jarvis Cocker, Damon Albarn, PJ Harvey, Anna Calvi, all these artists that mean an awful lot to us, started to collaborate with her and write with her. You know, Nick and Warren have worked on her last six albums. And that kind of made us turn, you know, that turned our head and made us take her more seriously. And then a producer brought the idea to us, and we just thought, what a remarkable place to start. This is somebody that we haven't grown up a fan of. We don't know everything about them, but how great that we might be able to set a record straight and to tell the story from a clean slate, you know, to approach it completely afresh.
Because I think depending on who you are, and I suppose depending on when you grew up, you will have a different perception of Marianne Faithfull. There's the whole girlfriend of Mick Jagger, which is always drawn out. There's that 1960s pop icon face, there's that incredible voice. There's the 1980s comeback. And she was no pushover as a person. I'm wondering that when you met her in October 2021, she was in a very different situation at that point. Her health had been very damaged by COVID. So what was that like the first time you met her?
Oh, I mean, she's still no pushover at that point. It was absolutely terrifying meeting her, and I think that we had to pass a test in a way. She I said nervously, "Oh, Marianne, hello. It's so wonderful to meet you. How are you?" And she said, "Well, how the hell do you think I am? Look at me. Look at me." And I laughed. And I think I passed the test in that moment. I think she saw, you know, she saw that we got her. She's an amazing artist. But over there, you have such a different view of her. You know, it's so, she absolutely loved being in Ireland, and she thought that that place was a haven for her and her creativity. It completely changed her world. It really did. It helped her kind of regain her feet, I think.
I'm interested to know, because there's not an enormous amount of that contained within the documentary itself, and obviously you can't touch on everything in somebody's life throughout the course of a brief documentary like this. Why was that?
We mainly kind of followed the things that really lit her up. And of course, we did talk about Shell Cottage in one of the film days that we were. But to be honest, it didn't have any substance. It didn't have a through line that connected us to these much grittier, much more muscular bits of her story. Whereas, you know, talking about the origins of her talent and her kind of interests in music coming from folk rather than pop, her being friends with the beat poets and learning a kind of much more radically interesting, open-minded kind of countercultural way of thinking, that is incredibly surprising to those of us who only encountered her through the pop charts, really.
Okay.
That all felt much juicier.
Yeah, I want to take something from the film. So let's hear from Tilda Swinton encapsulating Marianne Faithfull in 1 minute.
The building is old and my team is small, but let's not get into all that now. It's time to prove our concept. The more we uncover, the more confident I am that Marianne is the perfect choice for our first subject. We can't risk waiting any longer. A career spanning 6 decades, over 30 albums, a vast stream of adoring collaborators, everyone from Paul McCartney to Metallica to the Vienna Radio Symphony Orchestra, a Grammy nomination for Broken English, the Commander des Arts et des Lettres awarded by the French government, it goes on. She survived addiction, overdoses, cancer, and more recently a coma brought about by COVID. And yet to the world at large, she's still just Mick Jagger's ex-girlfriend. Well, fuck that.
What did she make of the concept when you did convince her to take part in the documentary and you explained the nature of how she was going to participate in it? What did she make of that?
Well, she was wary at first, thankfully. You know, we were too. I think that our work tends to push into territory that it's right. You know, it's a little pretentious. It uses construct. It's trying to do something new. And I think it's right to be wary of that. But Marianne has lived her life in the height of theatricality, steeped in the poets and playwrights. She, even in the care home, when we went to see her room was lavish and it had portraits of Francis Bacon on the wall, books everywhere. You know, she created her own creative universe. And I think we needed to give her a stage, a space in the film, that met her with some of that creativity. You know, the dryness of a documentary or the sort of blankness of a Wikipedia entry just doesn't serve anybody's life story well. We needed to bring her heart and her soul onto the screen. And I think the Ministry of Not Forgetting gave us a starting chance at that. And it turned out pretty good. Tilda Swinton did a damn good job, didn't she?
Yeah, and I think I like George MacKay very much. He takes the role of the record keeper here, which means that he's the one who's talking to Marianne most of the time and taking on what would be the traditional role of an interviewer in this situation. He's a great interviewer. Aside from everything else, he seems to do an absolutely wonderful job of just leading her gently along. How much of that was scripted, and how much of that is George just walking down laneways that he felt might work?
So it's very sort of semi-scripted. Because Marianne's entirely improvised, George had to really think on his feet. We're so lucky that we've worked with George a number of times now on varying projects. And we know him really, really well as a person. And I think that we need, when we're working with actors in these improvised documentary style projects, we need to know what reserves they're going to pull on. And with George, he has the warmest heart and the most curious of minds. And I think you see that on screen, that he wanted to create space for her to really open up and try and sort of think afresh about, you know, her life, some of which was being shown to her. And because of the effects of COVID, it was almost like she was seeing it for the first time, or like she was meeting an old friend in this army of younger Mariannes that turned up to take part in the film.
You would expect in a documentary like this to have the traditional lineup of talking heads, as so many documentaries do. You don't go down that route at all, but at the same time, you still manage to allow people to have their say about Marianne, but just in very different ways.
Yeah, do you know, I often feel when I'm watching documentaries that use talking heads, that it's about that person sort of elbowing their way into another person's story, trying to kind of create a piece in brackets with, you know, I'm relevant because here's the reason. And those sorts of tangents don't really build up a kind of fulfilling, wholesome, you know, picture. You really want to be able to let that person speak for themselves. And when I say speak for herself, I mean, Marianne does an awful lot with just her eyes and her face in this film. Just the act of us watching her, watching herself, her younger self, her broken self, her brilliant self doing, you know, the seven deadly sins, all of these kind of, the way her face takes it in, I think speaks so much to us. We're all very literate in reading nuanced gestures of the human face. And Marianne's got an amazing face to watch. So we tried to let it do quite a lot of the speaking. And then, yeah, use people in other ways.
One of those ways, and it's a really interesting one, is there's a debate at one point in the film that feels almost like a recording of a podcast. There's various women, including Edith Bowman is there, and Sophie Fiennes and Natasha Khan, and they're all commenting on the misogyny and the sexism that she was up against right from the start. She had an enormous amount to contend with pretty much from day one, didn't she?
She did, yes. And you know what's so interesting? Marianne, in the first 3 days of filming that we did with her and George, there's that moment where George puts the newspaper of Redlands in front of her. And she says to him, no, I don't care for that much. I'm not going to talk about that. But you can show it to them. And at the time of filming, we had no idea who she meant. Did she mean us, the directors, or the audience? I don't know. I don't know who she meant. But we kept coming back to that moment in the edit, and then we were like, oh, wait a minute, we could create a them and make it feel like she knew that they were there, and then just picked, you know, from the creme de la creme, you know, somebody from film, like you say, Sophie Fiennes, somebody from art history, Katie Hessel, some brilliant people, Harriet Viner, who wrote the Bob Robert Fraser biography and had done so much research on the Redlands drug bust. And it was a great way of being able to stretch out and explore, again, all improvised, explore a topic that has still means a lot, still resonates a lot for a lot of contemporary female artists. But to do it without having to make Marianne trudge over that stuff again.
I want to get some Marianne herself in here. The song Broken English is a huge turning point for her as an artist. She wrote it in the late 1970s, and here she is looking back at it.
About broken English.
Yeah.
That's the result of an identity that's been flattened and is suddenly allowed to come up. I became myself, and it was not the person people thought I was. It was more intelligent, stronger.
It felt as if I was really finally doing something for myself that was very important. Mm. I acted in that. You know, if I die now, what have I done? Nothing. That's what I thought.
Was there a moment that you realised this is what I'm meant to be doing?
Yeah. As I was writing, I would have a feeling that, OK, I'm here now. This is what it is. This is it.
You have a lot of collaborators in this film as well who are singers themselves. Beth Orton is in the film, Courtney Love, they perform, Suki Waterhouse, they do covers. What do you think her legacy is to the singer-songwriters who came after her?
I mean, she's clearly had such an incredible impact on a lot of artists. She really is truly an artist's artist. You know, she's the real deal. I mean, Warren Ellis has said that to us so many times. She really is the real deal. But she is so, in the public eye, so underrated. We're about to start, as you know, tomorrow, in playing this film across countries. And wherever we can, we're going to take some of these supporters, these artists, who came out in their legions when we were looking for people to contribute to the film, to come with us and try and play at events and be there to support the film. It's really meaning a lot to have that crowd of people who dearly loved her and clearly rated her talent coming with us.
The film ends on a joyful note, despite that Tilda Swinton talks to screen about her having passed away before the film was completed. She sings a song with Nick Cave and Warren Ellis is there. And there's so much love in that room at the end for that performance. It's an extraordinary way to end the film.
Oh, that was one of the happiest days of my life, let alone Marianne's life. And it's the happiest I ever saw Marianne. She was in her element. We'd been so unsure whether she would be able to be well enough to make it to the studio or able to stay for longer than, say, 20 minutes. Certainly weren't totally confident that she was going to be able to sing. But, oh, my God, she pulls it out of the bag so incredibly. To be in the room with those people and their shared admiration for one another. It was a real treat. It really was.
OK, I want to play a little bit of that. This is Marianne Faithfull, along with Nick Cave, singing Misunderstanding from the film.
I just have to trust Nick Cave.
Well, I'm just coming in. I'm just coming in all.
Which isn't always easy.
I'm a reformed character.
Yeah.
Give me a break. Right.
No, I know you are, Doug.
It's still completely untrustworthy.
A bit iffy.
I'm still working
You're
on that.
You're still a bit iffy.
OK, a bit iffy.
Yeah.
That's my tombstone. Nick Cave, a bit iffy.
Yes. That's good.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, I like it.
Let's do Misunderstanding.
Yeah, I agree.
OK, rolling, everyone.
Hang on. 1, 2, 3, 4...
Misunderstanding is my name. What I am is not a game. Such an easy trap to fall for anyone. And then you find yourself alone. No explanation you can give that you or I believe.
That's Marianne Faithfull along with the voice of Nick Cave there, and Warren Ellis is on that as well, performing Misunderstanding from the very end of the documentary. It's been absolutely lovely to talk to you, and I hope the film brings you nothing but extraordinary success. Jane Pollard, thanks for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
Broken English is screening at the Lighthouse Cinema tomorrow night at 6 o'clock as part of the Dublin International Film Festival. You'll find more details at diff.ie. And Broken English will go on general release in Irish cinemas on March 20th, so you'll have a chance to see it then. And you're listening to Tuesday night's Arena. As If Nothing Could Fall, Essays on Monuments is the fourth essay collection in an intriguing series from PVA Books, one of whose editors is the writer Adrian Duncan. Previous books have taken animals, music and film as their themes, but now 17 writers from Amit Choudhary to Lara Pawson have contributed a range of personal reflections from the epic to the intimate. Roisin Kybert and Gavin Corbett are with me in studio to talk about their own essays and about others they liked as well, and you're both very welcome to Arena.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Gavin, I'm going to start with you. You're the author of three novels, Green Glowing Skull, the latest, and a book of photos with text, The Giving Light. So how does writing a personal essay like this compete? I mean, I know there's a shorter word count to begin and the brief is very different, but in comparison to your other writing.
Yeah, I find it harder. I've always found it harder to write non-fiction because I never know how I'm supposed to sound. I never like my own voice in non-fiction. I don't know what my voice is meant to be in non-fiction because you're meant to write as yourself. I find it much easier to write as a character in a voice that I make up and just go along with the voice, just tune up to that voice and just allow the voice to sort of take me wherever. So I find writing as myself to be very... very stop-start, and I find myself writing very hesitantly, and I never like the results. I always think I sound very pompous.
You said yes to this.
And yet I said yes to this. But I say no more often to nonfiction. But I think Adrian knows that I like... This is Adrian Duncan, one of the editors that you mentioned. He knows I like... architecture anyway. I've written about architecture before. He knows I like writing about materials, as in solid materials like concrete and stone and metal, as he does. I think he's one of the best writers on materials out there. So we thought, I'll toss Gavin a bone and a check and give him a chance. And this was the result, my essay in this book.
Monuments is the brief, and there are a lot of very different takes on that within the course of the book. You've gone for, rather than large monuments, ones that are much smaller.
Yeah, that's right. I was conscious that among 17 writers, at least a few of them would write about the big stuff. You know, the word monument itself, it suggests monumental. It's onomatopoeically, it's a very kind of, somber word. I mean, the word monument itself is derived from the old French monere, which means tomb. So it just sort of carries that semantic trace in it. Anyway, so I thought I'll do something smaller and a lot, more lighthearted. So I went to a graveyard and I settled on a humble little grave. And I thought, rather than kind of address what a monument is or what a monument can be, I just, very simply start with that and kind of nudge my way forward from that.
Maybe tell us a little bit about the story, about where then that leads you.
Well, the grave in question... that I mentioned, that I just happened upon by accident, is the grave of a man called Brian Travascus, who died aged 40 back in 1980. And I noted that both his parents were buried with him. They had predeceased him by only a couple of years. I think one of the parents died in 77, the other 78. And then so Brian followed in 1980. So that intrigued me. I recognised the name immediately, Travascus, and Brian Travascus. I'd heard of this name, Brian Travascus, in relation to the Late Late Show. I remember when, whenever there's a transition from presenter to presenter in the Late Late Show, you always see these, you always get these discussions in the press and media about highlights of the Late Late Show. And Brian Travascus' infamous appearance on the Late Late Show in 1966 invariably comes up. But I recognise the name also... as it relates to my own family, because my grandparents' first house, the first house that they owned, that they eventually bought, because they were moved in there, first of all, because my grandfather worked for the Great Western and Midland Railway Company. There were railway cottages. They eventually bought that house, and then they sold that house to the Travascus family in 1955. So it was a way of kind of writing about... my own family, and myself, of course, I come back to myself, but also about this absolutely fascinating character and a fascinating time in Irish history. With the word monument in my head kind of ringing there like a motif, I found myself writing about monuments. I found myself writing about the grave, what a grave contains, what it means. I found myself writing about Broadstone Station and this little house in Great Western Square in Phibsborough that housed two families.
Roisin, yours is very different in that it takes an actual monument as its centrepiece. You're an author. People might know you from The Disconnect, from your book that was published in 2021. You have another new work of nonfiction coming out later this year. Do I have that right?
Yeah, The Most Normal Woman, it's called.
And that's coming out when?
In August, with Tramp Press.
Okay. In this collection, your essay is entitled The Most Virtuous Man. Tell us about your inspiration for this.
I like superlatives, as you can tell. It's funny, Gavin, you were saying about like doing less nonfiction. I feel like sometimes for the last few years, my whole life has just been consumed by nonfiction, specifically the essay. I've been like teaching it, editing it with The Stinging Fly and writing it and working on this new book coming out as well. And so I actually think I was approaching this piece from a place of almost kind of exhaustion with the traditional essay and wanting to do something very different. About 2 years ago, I read the book A Place of Greater Safety by Hilary Mantel, which is about the French Revolution. It's better than her Tudor's books even, which are already fabulous. But it just kind of unlocked something for me because she's writing about real historical events, but she's making them alive and she's making them into really juicy fiction. It's like this mad... The French Revolution is like a soap opera to me. So after that, I just had to do something and I couldn't let go of the person and character of Robespierre.
And tell me about where your essay goes, because you start with Robespierre at the beginning and he's the centrepiece of this. So tell me how you work
that. I mean, I don't know if I'd even call this a straight up essay, and it's not quite fiction either. It's something in between. It takes place, it's written in the second person, but it's really inside the mind of Maximilian Robespierre. And the day is a very auspicious day. He's launching his own religion for revolutionary France called the Cult of the Supreme Being. You know, when you launch your own cult, things aren't going to take a turn.
Particularly with the word supreme being.
L'être suprême. And he doesn't know this. He's having the best day of his life. It's all like, I imagine it looking like folk horror, like the film Midsommar with like Shirley Jackson's story, the lottery, that kind of vibe, like sinister celebrations in broad daylight. But he doesn't know that 6 weeks later, he's going to get the guillotine himself.
Will you read a little from the essay for us, please?
Yes. I made a bookmark. Not long ago, you dreamed of the guillotine. You were standing at its foot under a clear summer sky. It was uncertain in this dream if you were being executed or were the executioner. You woke with a vague sense of pressure about the neck, flat on your front, as though in guillotine rehearsal. What must it be like to pass through that portal? Now you dwell on it nightly, a journey that begins with lying down. But today is not for these thoughts, not with all this colour and the talk of vertu, the radiant children united in song. You are happy, the happiest you've ever been. You are climbing the artificial hill in the centre of the Champ de Mars, leading a line of maidens in white dresses, sabre-carrying boys, mothers of soldiers, the blind and the bereaved and the honourable poor, elevated in the eyes of the supreme being himself.
You definitely read it much, much faster than I read it in my own head when I was reading it. Gavin, what have you chosen to read from your essay? It's obviously tonally quite different.
I've chosen to read the start, which is the worst part. It doesn't really get going until the middle, but I'll read it anyway. And I'll read really slowly to make up for all the time that you ate through there, Roisin. Okay, so my piece is called Containing a Life. I visited Glasnevin Cemetery almost every day when I lived near its Finglas Road gate. Twice a week for a year, it was a shortcut to my little boy's creche, the other side of the Prospect Square gate. I remember being aware, as I pushed him through in the buggy, of the symbolism of the yew berries gumming up the wheels. I thought perhaps I'd write about it someday. Remembering now that detail, I recall also the tall beech trees with their bark like dulled smoky silver. Another tree with a face in it like Paddy Maloney's from The Chieftains. The sensation of the tough beech shells and hard sweet chestnuts under the soft rubber soles of my shoes. And I remember the sign that read, Monument Works. Yep.
And that's from your essay, From As If Nothing Could Fall, Essays on Monuments from PVA Books, which is what we're talking about at the moment. We asked both of you to choose a second piece. Gavin, you chose Gail McConnell's essay, Monumental Play. It also starts with a gravestone as well, but maybe tell us about that and why it stood out for you.
I thought this was really wonderful. Gail McConnell, she was the daughter, she is the daughter of a man who was murdered by the IRA. William McConnell was his name. He was a prison officer, worked in the Mays prison, and he was murdered in front of Gail when she was only a child, and murdered in front of her mother as well. And the essay starts, as you say, with a grave, with this image of a girl mourning at a grave, and as you read on, you realise that she's being asked to perform grief at this headstone, this sort of coquettish version of grief by a magazine photographer who'd come over to document, I think it was a religious magazine, document the Baptist Church or document the Baptist Church in Ireland. And for that reason, Gail felt very resistant to the idea of monuments, of these structures that were, instructions to grieve or instructions to be very, very impressed by somebody, instructions to remember something, instructions to consider something. So an experience like Gail went through with that photographer would cause a lot of hurt, I guess. Later on in life, Gail became a very notable and successful poet, and her poetic practice is based on kind of bricolage of making these poems out of pre-existing material in a kind of Walter Benjamin type way of, and so she with her kind of most celebrated collection, The Sun Is Open, she used little bits of newspaper reports about her father's murder, and bits of the Bible, bits of her father's diary, bits of script from things like Banana Man and Super Ted and cartoons that were around when she was young, without actually addressing her father's murder, but inevitably making something about her father's murder, even in the kind of the way the text was typeset on the page, resembling a monolith. And I just found the way Gail sort of thought about monuments was exactly the way I think about monuments, as something that they're useless unless they're completed by the observer, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. We're just about run out of time on this. There are so many other amazing essays within this book that people can find out for themselves. But tonight, anyway, Roisin Kybert, Gavin Corbett, thanks so much for joining us on
Thank
Arena.
You.
The book is As If Nothing Could Fall, Essays on Monuments, and it's published by PVA Books.
Thank you.
Few careers in music and few love stories in music are as celebrated as that of June Carter and Johnny Cash, who spent almost 40 years together and recorded some of country music's most iconic songs. Their turbulent story has now been turned into a musical, which runs from March 31st to April 11th at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. Tonight we're joined in studio by the director and co-creator Des McAnuff, who's a bit of a legend himself, having directed some of the most groundbreaking musicals of recent decades, including Big River, Tommy and Jersey Boys. And Des, you're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll talk a little bit about your own career in a little while, but first I want to talk about the new show, about the Ballad of Johnny and June. Can you talk to me a little bit about how that came about?
Sure. I had a couple of, I have a couple of friends who explored getting the rights, and Michael David, Tommy Mottola, And Michael and I set off for Nashville one night to have a meeting to talk about this, to see what it was. And I had no particular, you know, strong idea about how to do this or tell the story. I didn't even know much about Johnny Cash beyond, you know, the movie Walk the Line and, you know, just anecdotal information and so on. We were meeting John Carter Cash quite early in the morning, having arrived very late at night in Nashville and couldn't get a sandwich. And so I think we managed to get an egg in the morning. We're waiting for him to come in and the phone rings and his manager picks up the phone. And it's John Carter Cash. That's who we're meeting with. He says he's in Amsterdam and he got the dates mixed up. We just kind of look at each other and go, oh, great. Here we've come to Nashville. And then 30 seconds later, he walks in the room. And so I knew from that we were going to have a great time together. And he basically told me, and I hope it's true, that his dad's favorite musical was Big River, something that I directed. And so I didn't really have to audition for John Carter Cash. He wanted me to do it, you know, right from the get-go, which was very generous of him. And so I brought in Robert Carey to share the book writing responsibilities with me. And Rob has done really the lion's share of the writing. And we spent lots of time in Hendersonville and in Nashville and with John Carter. And it's really been a fabulous ride. I've got to say, it's been a really joyous experience, and I hope audiences will find it the same way here.
It's a very, very broad story to tell for a single piece of theater. So how did you in those early days go about deciding this is what we're focusing on and this is where we're going to place our story?
That is the most pertinent question you could ask about process. Because that is exactly the challenge. So what we did is we spent a lot of time just listening to all of the music that Johnny recorded, or as much as we could take in, and June Carter too, and the Carter family. And we started then just in a general way talking about the themes that we wanted to emphasize and to come up with a kind of timeline. And more it became, in a sense, it's John Carter's story. He's going back to kind of play the movies in his head of his parents and from stories he'd heard, because, of course, he wasn't there for most of their relationship. You know, he was only born in about 1970, I think. So we spent a lot of time doing that. And obviously, Red did a lot of research. John Carter's written several books. There are a couple of very good biographies. So we did all that, you know, and then created an outline. And that's really where the play is created. Musicals, I think Alan J. Lerner said this, musicals are talked into existence. They're not, in a sense, really written. You know, you talk them into existence. And that's quite literally what we did. And the decision that we made that was key was we decided to focus on not just June and Johnny and John Carter, but their relationship with addiction. So the other character in this play is addiction. And much of it is about these people that we fall in love with, hopefully, rising above the addiction, fueled by their love for each other. But it does definitely have some dark tones. And I dare say that most people will recognize this, sadly, from their own lives, either because of a friend or a relative or maybe even a close relative. And so that became the mission. And while that sounds kind of dark, the fact is I think it is kind of uplifting and joyous, too, because it involves love.
Isn't it true that most of the best musicals have a dark heart somewhere in them?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at even something that seems on the surface frivolous, like Pajama Game, it's about unions and management and the relationship between them. And so I think that's absolutely true. There's always something dark. And sometimes it can be quite dark, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. A wonderful show that I've had the privilege of working on is, you know, there's not a sincere moment in that show. And it's a scathing attack on the American business community in the early 60s. And so you're right. There's got to be lemon juice in there to, you know, to go with the honey.
Okay, let's remind ourselves of some of the wonderful music of Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash. This is the two of them performing Jacks.
We got married in a fever, hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. I'm going to Jackson, I'm gonna mess around. Yeah, I'm going to Jackson. Look out, Jackson Town.
We'll go on down to Jackson. Go ahead and wreck your hell. Go play your hand, you big tough man. Make a big fool of yourself. Yeah, go to Jackson. Go comb your hair.
Honey, I'm gonna snowball Jackson.
So at the heart of the musical, as well as the story you're telling, there is, of course, the music. So how do you approach choosing the songs that ultimately are going to make the cut here? And how do you approach how they're going to be performed and what you do with those songs?
I think everything has to serve a story when you're doing a musical. And, you know, you choose the story. And that is honestly the most important decision. What story are we telling? You know, occasionally you can get a song in there sideways. But generally speaking, all the songs have to advance the cause. As it turns out, when you're dealing with a performer like Johnny or a performer like June, there are moments when they created songs that obviously folded into their lives in a meaningful way. You can't not do Ring of Fire or Walk the Line. You have to get into the Carter family history. So in a sense, you kind of luck out because the most significant songs obviously have everything to do with their lives. But I think there's also then the kind of thematic content, a song like Singer of Songs or some of the darker tunes that obviously pertain to addiction, they find their way into the story very, very naturally. And in a sense, this sounds a little bit like hocus pocus, but I think when you're doing a biography, you feel like the people that you're writing about are kind of talking to you through their work. And, you know, you have to listen to them. We had the great advantage of having John Carter Cash, and we got to spend time at the cabin in, you know, Hendersonville, which is, you know, grandfather had actually created. And so that was a big leg up on this show, you know, the fact that we could ask him questions. And he gave us a generous amount of time, and we got to hang out at the Grand Ole Opry, and he was our host. So that was a particular advantage, and you don't always, you know, get that in a show.
So with the help of John Carter Cash, you then shed new light on their relationship, because there's this established view of June being a sort of semi-saintly figure who helps John the sinner and brings him to some form of redemption. I mean, that's not necessarily how it was in real life, though.
Very good. You know, you're absolutely right. And John Carter was very bullish about having us tell the real story. He didn't want a fairy tale. And as good a movie, I think Walk the Line is a very good movie, and it did incredibly well, I'm told, here in Ireland. It is really a fairy tale. And obviously there are many nuggets of truth in it, but it does give you probably the wrong impression of what the relationship between Johnny and June was about. June suffered from addiction too. And after they got together, you know, she had a real problem with pills. They both did. I think she was also in denial about that. And John Carter really wanted that story to be told. He didn't want to perpetuate the myth of Johnny and June. And if you don't mind, while we're at this, I just want to say something else that I think is interesting about their story. Because Johnny, inherited the crown of the prince of country music from Hank Williams, who in turn had, you know, inherited it from Jimmy Rogers. And because she was a member of the Carter family, and they essentially, you know, you could say they almost created country music. They certainly popularized it. It was like a medieval marriage. It was like bringing these two, it was like she could have been from Austria and he could have been from Denmark or England, or it was this marriage that had this tremendous impact on American popular culture. And they were aware of that. I'm sure they were aware of it. You know, it was a great romance and they loved each other and they survived their, you know, they got through their addictions and the family addictions together. But there was this other calling, which is they understood the significance they had in terms of country music. And I like that about them, you know, that it isn't just some sort of gooey love story, you know, that they knew what they were doing as artists.
I want to talk to you about the Irish Connection, but I'm going to do it after this, because this is Johnny Cash with a song he wrote while he was in Ireland that lots of people will know. It's 40 Shades of Green.
I close my eyes and picture the emerald of the sea from the fishing boats that dingle to the shores of Dunedee. I miss the River Shannon and the folks at Skibbereen, the moorlands and the meadows with their 40 shades of green.
And that is Johnny Cash doing 40 Shades of Green, a song he wrote while he was on a trip here in 1959. I want to ask you about starting out off Broadway in the 70s, and then you spent time at the La Jolla Playhouse, and that became a sort of engine of original American theatre and some musical theatre too.
I think the history of La Jolla Playhouse involved musicals because of a kind of happy accident. And I'm very proud of the musicals that have come out of La Jolla. I think La Jolla has only been in existence in its current form since 1983. It was, in fact, initially founded by Gregory Peck, Dorothy McGuire, and Mel Ferrer in the late 40s, but it stopped performing in the early 60s. And there had been a 20-year hiatus when I came along as artistic director. So it was essentially a clean sheet operation. It was a new theater. And I think we've now sent something like 40 shows to Broadway in that relatively short period of time. And again, musicals obviously are the shows that people recognize and talk about. But I think the Playhouse has probably done almost as many classics as musicals, and certainly more new plays than musicals, because in the course of a season you might have two musicals, but you're inevitably going to have a classic or two and maybe three or four new plays. So the Playhouse is very much about eclecticism, and that's what the American theater's about. It's not about, and this is, I suppose, what America's famous for, you know, and I hope it continues, which is adopting other cultures, welcoming other cultures, and celebrating them. And so, you know, in Russia, you have two basic schools of theater, the psychological and the metaphorical. In America, you've got dozens of forms of theater. It's a very, very confused place culturally. And that's what the Playhouse is about. But early on, a producer named Rocco Landisman, who's a very dear friend of mine, ran Jujamson Theater Chain. He loved country music. He loved Roger Miller, and he loved Huckleberry Finn. And happily, he liked me. So he got us all together and said, you know, do this Huckleberry Finn show, Big River, and we'll open it at your theater, and your theater can share in the success if we have one. And so we did that. And when we got into that, we realized, hey, this is a pretty good thing. They're very popular with audiences. They serve as a kind of gateway to other work. They can help you fund other work. And so we have done a lot of successful musicals there over the years.
I do want to ask you about a show that's been to Dublin more than once, and that's Jersey Boys, the story of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I mean, the idea of a musical about them didn't exactly scream hit in the early double O's when it came along, did it? Why did that come about?
You know, when I first got it, I shouldn't say this because I'll get in trouble with my colleagues, but I'm going to say it. When it was first sent to me, I didn't want to do it. I felt like it didn't, you know, address the fact that they were really these blue-collar kids from Belleville playing a rather gritty form of doo-wop and rock and roll. I wasn't quite feeling it. And happily, Marshall Brickman and Rick Ellis, the writers, and my partner, Michael David, wouldn't let me say no and came back a couple of times and said, okay, what is it that you think can be improved? And they were gracious enough to listen. All directors have lots of opinions, and I certainly do, and I had lots of opinions. And they were, you know, again, just classy enough to agree to collaborate. And so we used what they'd written for sure, but created a kind of a new outline. And I think a lot of people aren't aware of, and that's probably true of Johnny Cash, by the way, of how many songs the Seasons actually created and as a group, you know. And it's not until you hear the show or you see the show that you realize that they had literally dozens, I think they had 17 songs on the charts. But the main thing about Big River, and it's true of anything you put on stage, is the story. So the great thing about Jersey Boys is it has a fabulous story, and we found this sort of Rashomon way of doing it, you know, from four different points of view. And I think the songs definitely elevate the show, there's no question. But really, at the core of Jersey Boys is a fabulous story. Two of them had done, I think it was, when you put them together, I think they'd done something like, you know, 34 years in the tank, you know, from the juvie, from when they were teenagers. They'd spent so much time in prison. So it did make for a really fantastic story. That's how it happened.
I could spend the rest of the evening talking to you. It's been a joy to have you in. Thank you so much, Des McAnuff, for joining us on Arena.
Oh, thank you so much.
Des McAnuff, the director and co-creator of The Ballad of Johnny and June. It is opening at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre on March 31st and runs until April 11th. You'll find more information at boardgáisenergytheatre.ie. And we may as well play some Four Seasons. Very baby, my mother will be thrilled by that. She's really, really happy to into that because she's a great fan of that particular musical. Right, that's it. We finish up on Arena tonight. We'll take a look at the new film about Paul McCartney's formation of Wings. It's called Man on the Run. Tomorrow night, the Blue Raincoat Theatre Company will tell us about their new production in Sligo. It's called Ubu Roi and it's from 1896. And we'll be talking to the makers of a new documentary about visionary animator Don Bluth. Tonight's programme, produced by Reg Luby. Paula Shields is our researcher. Broadcast coordinators Ollie Hamilton and Kieran Cullen was on sound. John Creedon is up after the news.